listening to the CCA Podcast. Such a privilege, and I knew it would be difficult to even consider kind of trying to wrap up what do you say on the final Sunday. Of course, those of you who know me recognize that I was really worried about, okay, are the tears just going to flow through the whole thing? And it could be that they'll come. I'm not sure. There's a certain numbness that has set in, I have to admit, because there have been so many emotions over these last few weeks. I walked in the lobby just before coming out, and saw, like, man, that guy looks like one of my uncles, and it's my brother. Jim and Renee, where are you guys? Why don't you stand? Because you guys haven't met Jim and Renee yet, but my brother Jim, his wife Renee, a lot of you would know who Renee is because she's an Enlo, so she's Rick, one of the former pastors. She's Rick's sister. She always kept Rick in line too for years and years. So then I see a whole bunch of other faces and people coming, especially to greet us. So we'll have time downstairs. It's going to be fun. I promised that I was going to keep this message short. I probably, you're betting out there on that, whether that's really going to happen, and probably most of you betted like, no, there's no way he's going to keep it short, but I'm going to work at it. We're in the middle of a series called How to Neighbor, and so it was like, well, do I stick with that theme? Do I stick with that title? And I thought, yeah, it's fitting. It really is. Over the past several weeks, we've been talking about what does it mean to neighbor? Based on what James calls the royal commandment, Jesus said the second greatest commandment, to love our neighbor as ourselves. And one of the things we talked about last week was just how crucial it is that in order to love the newcomer, in order to neighbor the newcomer, that we are a church that is safe, that's a safe place. Safe for questions, safe for differences, safe for weakness. You know, I've been reflecting on that all week, really, about our weaknesses and how that so often we focus on our weaknesses before we focus on our strengths. It just is such a natural part of what we do. We look at our deficiencies and our faults. This week, I was sharing from a book that I'd been recently kind of rereading called The Emotionally Healthy Church, and I referred to it last week. I was reading an excerpt from The Emotional Healthy Church to the staff, and in the context of reading that, we were sitting right here and we were praying over the service today. And in the context of doing that, I said, boy, you know, rereading this, it's like, man, I really wish that I'd taken the time to read through this as a staff. And Scott, he says, that's exactly like you. You're always focusing on the things that you wish you'd done. That's like typical. And I thought, wait a minute, that is. You know, that's so typical of me and my character. Walking into church this morning and coming in the parking lot, and it's like, oh, shoot, I was going to get those weeds before today, you know? Why didn't I make sure those weeds were out of there? And so for me in leaving, how many of you are like that? You're about to go on vacation, you're ready to, and it's like, blah, you know, all these things that you've been putting off and you were fine with up until then, now it's like, oh, I got to get this done. And that's what's happening to me. It's like, oh, all the missed opportunities, you know, all the girls I never dated. No, I don't. I did have to get in one sort of flub slip in there just to be typical in Pakoda. Yeah, all the things that we wish we'd done. I was reflecting on the book that was written by Eugene Peterson, who passed away not all that long ago, who wrote a book called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. A Long Obedience in the Same Direction is a book about the Psalms of Ascent, psalms that the Israelites sang and quoted and recited to one another as they were on pilgrimage on the way up to Jerusalem. And so they're called Songs of Ascent because you're steadily climbing as you move toward Jerusalem and then ultimately to the crown of the hill where the temple was. And they would make their way and they'd sing those songs of ascent. And so, fittingly, Eugene Peterson called it a long obedience in the same direction. Actually, he took that quote from Nietzsche. Nietzsche said in his book Beyond Good and Evil, he said, "The essential thing in heaven and earth is apparently that there should be long obedience in the same direction. There thereby results, and has always resulted, in the long run, something which has made life worth living." Now, Nietzsche was an atheist and did not share a Christian worldview. In fact, his whole focus on power and will and the ability of the new mensch, you know, the new supermensch, to be able to overcome and through sheer force of will, that was Nietzsche, and in some ways he was a precursor for Hitler. I mean, but like many, there are certain bits of wisdom that come out of their language, and Nietzsche said anything that counts has always consisted of a long obedience. There it comes, yeah. A long obedience in the same direction. And I think if anything that I would love to leave with the congregation, it's this truth that's what we've been on. That's the journey that we've been on. That's the journey that I've been on in this congregation since the time I was 5 years old. And Karen, since she was born, but she only lasted 2 years and then came back, you know. But it's a steady footstep, a long obedience in the same direction. And I asked specifically for Bino and Chelsea to sing the song "Read On," because you don't have to change the book to turn the page. You don't have to close the book to turn the page. We are in this book together. We're in this amazing, fantastic narrative called, you know, Kingdom of God, called Journey with Jesus, called Discipleship, called Following Him. And in our followership, we are on a steady pathway. And so our 12 years here have been just a part of that. And that is going to continue, certainly, without our presence. It's going to be that same footbeat. It's going to, do you say footbeat? I don't know. And the march, the beat of our feet, moving forward, a long obedience in the same direction. Probably because it is the last week, I've been sort of turning back to some old themes and old ideas. I picked up Dietrich Bonhoeffer, The Cost of Discipleship, again this week. Bonhoeffer, in that book, reflects on the call that Jesus gave to his disciples and what it means to be called. He finds it remarkable, and I think it is remarkable as well, that the people responded to Christ's call seemingly without forethought, without any reflection, without knowledge. We tend to say, well, wait a minute. You know, they just dropped their nets and followed him. They just, you know, he said, "Matthew, I'm coming to your house today," and it's like, well, okay. People people just responded immediately, and we kind of think, well, they must have known something about Jesus. They must have met him or heard about him. But Scripture doesn't give us any indication of that. Scripture intentionally is telling us, is revealing to us that it's the sheer authority of Jesus. Jesus called and people responded. All they needed was obedience in saying, yes, I'll follow. That's important because it says something very essential about our relationship with Jesus. The disciples were not called because of their qualifications. They weren't called because of their excellent leadership skills or their exceptional faithfulness. And they also didn't volunteer. They didn't come up and say, pick me. You know, I'll be a good team member. I'll be a good one. Pick me. Ooh, you know, that wasn't it at all. Jesus is walking along the seashore, and he says, come and follow me, and I'll make you fishers of men. And they drop their nets and follow him. There's a quote in your notes. Discipleship is not an offer man makes to Christ. It is only the call which creates the situation. Discipleship is not an offer. We don't offer our services. It's the call. And Jesus has called you and me. He has spoken a word and he said, follow me. It's going to be a long obedience in the same direction. It's going to cost something. It's going to cost actually your life. If any man would come after me, let him take up his cross daily and follow me. So Dietrich Bonhoeffer says it in these words, when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. It's a long obedience in the same direction. Now, when it comes to this process of then neighboring or being a neighbor to those around us, that long obedience in the same direction is a part of that. I entitled the sermon today, and I actually kind of like this title. It's, go ahead and stick it up there. We neighbor because he first neighbored us. Now, of course, that's an allusion to 1 John 4:19, which says what? We love because he first loved us. We neighbor because he first neighbored us. In some ways, this call to be good neighbors to all those around us could be an oppressive weight. It could weigh us down because we're so aware of our own deficiencies, of our own selfishness. How do we neighbor well? How do we pour out love to a broken world in a way that really is going to make a difference? And you know, I don't know about you, but in some ways, I am looking forward to this next phase. I don't know exactly all the things that God has in mind, but part of the reason I'm looking forward to the next phase is that there's not going to be that pressure on me to be a Christian. Now, what I mean by that is I get to be a Christian just because. I get to be a kind person just because. I get to serve others and pour into their life just because. Not because anybody's paying me to do it. Not because of any official title. Just because. This is going to be great. It's going to be really cool. It's like, I get to go to church next Sunday just because. Exactly. You know, you heard about the guy who... you know, came, young person came to his mom and said, "Mom, you know, I do not want to go to church. I just do not. I'm not going to go today. People don't like me. They're mean, and it's boring." And she said, "Son, you are getting up and you are going to church. One, because that's what faithfulness means. Two, because I want you to. And three, because you're the pastor." No, so. I'm not going to have that anymore. we get to do it just because. But I've been thinking about where does the motivation come from to stay on a long obedience in the same direction? And last week, I mentioned the TED Talk from Brené Brown, where she observed that people, the difference between people who have a wholeheartedness in their life and those who don't, simply comes down to one thing. Those who are wholehearted have a deep sense that they are worth being loved. They have a deep sense of worthiness. And so I was reflecting really all week, where does that worthiness come from? Three passages give us a clue. And these are three passages that have been a part of my life since the very beginning of my ministry life. They were cited by Jerry Cook in a book called Love, Acceptance, and Forgiveness. He was citing them often in his messages in his church, in East Hill Church in Gresham, Oregon. I went down as a very young man, brand new in ministry, and sat and listened to Jerry's teaching and was just struck by the power of it. Jerry said that the church needs to be, if it's going to be a safe place, it's got to be marked by these three qualities. And so today in your notes, those are the easiest fill in the blanks that you've ever heard, because you can get them all without even thinking about it. It's funny because Matthew, he would give kids, you know, sometimes a dollar if they could get all the fill in the blanks before I said them, you know. And everybody would have gotten it today. Dollars for everyone. A new commandment I give you: love one another as I have loved you. So you must love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. Love one another as I have loved you. Then in Romans 15:7, accept one another then, just as Christ accepted you, in order to bring praise to God. And then in Colossians 3:13, bear with each other and forgive whatever grievances you may have against one another. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. These commands, they show us what following looks like. They show us what neighboring looks like. They show us how a long obedience in the same direction is defined. In truth, they could overwhelm us. We simply don't have it in us. We are unloving, unaccepting, unforgiving so much of the time. Left to our own devices, we would fail miserably. But that's where that secret word "as" comes in to each of them. He doesn't just say love and accept and forgive. He says love as, accept as, forgive as. Jesus does it first. Before we're ever asked to love, we are extravagantly, recklessly loved. Before we ever are asked to accept, we are unconditionally, tenderly, heartily accepted. Before we're ever asked to forgive, we are completely, utterly, unequivocally forgiven. That's where the strength comes from. We neighbor because he first neighbored us. We can love, accept, and forgive because we are so loved, so accepted, and so forgiven. There's a picture that I love. I've shown it before. It's Rembrandt. Karen and I had the privilege of seeing this picture. It hangs in the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg, Russia. It's a marvelous piece of work, or piece of art. It's nearly life-size, and it's floor-to-ceiling in its height. And Henry Nouwen, who was a Dutch theologian and person who reflected on faith very often in such a deep way, he sat for 3 days in front of, he got special permission during the time when the museum was after hours, and to sit and just reflect on Rembrandt's the story of the prodigal. What you have is the father in the red robe, the prodigal who has come to him, and he's tenderly and he's embracing his son. The older brother to the right, he's wearing the robe just like the father. It's a sign of authority, sign of ownership, because he now really owns. He's the one to whom all the inheritance belongs, because the young son has already spent his inheritance. We don't know who the other two figures are, but the one in the back may, perhaps, something may be the mom. It's a powerful picture that helps make the story come alive. I would love for us to read it together. You have Pew Bibles in front of you, so I'm reading from the same version. It's the old NIV that's available in your Pew Bible. This is found in Luke chapter 15. And it begins with verse 11. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them." Not long, I want you to keep the picture up the whole time we're reading too, just so for reflection's sake. "Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his field to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. And he ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him." I want you to hold that thought for just a sec. Kenneth Bailey, in his book Poet and Peasant, who is a man who grew up in the Middle Eastern culture and is very familiar with it. He's a theologian masterclass. And he tells us about this particular parable. He said, one of the things that you never, ever see in a Middle Eastern culture, you never see an old man running. It never happens. Because it would be completely undignified to do so. In order to run, you have to lift up your skirts, the long robe that you're wearing. You have to lift that robe in order to not stumble and to run. And that would be to bare your feet and bare your lower legs. And to bare your lower legs is disgraceful. It just never happens. But what took place in this story is that Jesus is telling of the prodigal, and he went and he ran off. And when he did that, when he sold all of his possessions that his father had distributed to him, he made himself a curse in the community. Because you do not sell the land. You don't sell it to someone outside of the family. This is family land that stays together for generations and generations. And this young man, he said, I don't want to have anything to do with you. I don't want to have anything to do with your place. I don't have anything to do with your people. I'm out of here. And he went. But that meant he was absolutely verboten in his city. And to come back would be at risk of absolute scorn and rejection and possibly death. That people would say, you'd betrayed us, we're betraying you. But in the story, the father is waiting. He's waiting. Hopeful for the son to come back. And when he does see the son from afar off, he does the unspeakable, the act of disgracing himself that no one could imagine. He picks up his skirts and he runs. He runs to him and embraces him. He embraces him. Now it didn't, you know, so this is a little, you know, Rembrandt does this because he wants to get all the characters in. He wants to bring the older brother in. He gets the embrace and then he gets the older brother too. So the second part of the parable is then the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his fingers and sandals on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has him back safe and sound. And the older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him, but he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, and yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But then this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home. You kill the fatted calf for him. My son, the father said, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours, which is true, because the one half had already been given to the younger son. Now everything he has is his. Everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. It's a picture of what love, acceptance, and forgiveness really looks like. Last week I said that in response to shame, there are three different ways that we go about it. That the way we respond to shame is the gravitational pull of shame. Is we flee, we fight, we hide. We flee. The young man, the young son, he flees to another country. He gets involved with covering his pain and covering his shame in drugs and alcohol and sex, and we flee. Sometimes we fight. You know, it's interesting how fighting is often an expression of a sense of lack. This week, this is a really super little minor thing. So I had ordered, as you know, I'm really excited about going down to Yosemite, and I had ordered my Golden Pass, which is a card that gets you into all the national parks when you're 63 plus. You get in for free, you know, and it only costs, you know, $90. And so I was like all excited because I got my Golden Pass, and then I'd had it laying out on the coffee table, and it was just laying there. And then one day I realized, oh man, it's not there anymore. And there had been a bunch of papers laying with it. And so I thought, oh, okay, Karen picked it up and put it aside. So I waited a few days, and then Friday, I was looking for that pass in all the papers, and it was like it wasn't there. So then Karen comes home from work late, and I'm like, honey, do you know where that pass is? You know, I'm really going to need it for Yosemite. And she's like, well, no, where'd you put it? And I'd say, well, I didn't put it anywhere. It was on the coffee table, and it was with all that stuff. And she said, oh, yeah, I remember seeing it there. And, well, you moved it someplace, you know. And so then I'm like, so it got, you know, I held it down pretty good, but it was like, there's a little bit of this rough and tumble, like, well, but then I thought about it later, what was going on with that? Well, part of it was that I was kicking myself because I should have picked up that pass days ago and put it someplace safe, because I knew, you know, okay, this is important. I want to hold on to it. I was also kicking myself because if it did get thrown away in a pile, it probably was me who threw it away in a pile, you know, in a pile of papers. And it's like my own sense of shame about not doing it right comes out with toward Karen. How often do we do that? We flee, we fight, and we hide. The older brother was hiding in plain sight all those years, wondering if he was enough, not connecting with his father, distant. We flee, we fight, we hide, but what does the Lord do? What does the Lord do? He embraces. In his book, Henry Nouwen, he talks about that particular picture, and he talks about the difference between the hands. He sat and studied it for hours, and he says, you know, the left hand is strong and robust. It's different than the right hand. The fingers are more square, and they're more separated, and it's like he's pulling them in. He's holding them tight. You're not going to get away. The right hand is more tender. It's touching him in a tender kind of way. And he's holding him tight on the one hand and caressing him on the other. Jesus is in our journey, in our lifelong journey. He's holding us in, caressing us in a you know, in a gentle way. I've got you. I've got you. When we come to the Lord's table, it's a reminder to us of this very picture. Why is it possible to neighbor? Because he first neighbored us. Why is it possible to go on the journey with Jesus? Because sheerly on the basis of his call. He said, come follow me. He didn't say, come follow me because you're a superstar. He didn't say, come follow me because you got it all together. We can love, accept, and forgive others because we are so powerfully loved, accepted, and forgiven. And so in our continuing journey as a congregation, let's keep reading on in the same book. And I think it's totally fitting that the closing pastoral act of our ministry is that we would be able to come to the Lord's table and receive his embrace. Jesus, let us now, as we come to your table, some of us have run. Some of us have run away and covered up that running in activities that just were, you know, we've tried to numb the pain. We've fought and we've pushed back, and others we've hidden in plain sight, trying to be the good one, trying to do everything right. On the inside, Lord, knowing full well our own weakness and our own brokenness. And so now we just pile them up. We just pile them up to you. Our weakness, our brokenness, our pain. And we cast ourselves upon the incredible, incomprehensible love of God. Greater love has no man than this, than that he lays down his life for his friends. Jesus, that's what you did for us. And thank you that the ground is level at the foot of the cross. Thank you that your arms are held out in the wide embrace. And we say yes to you. And if you have not yet said your yes to Jesus, he said his immense yes to you from the very beginning. And he calls to you, and all that you need to do is to say, Jesus, forgive me. I come and I cast myself at your feet. And he'll take his strong hand and hold you in tight, and he'll take his soft hand and let you know just how loved and how accepted and how deeply forgiven you are.